Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sung-Yun Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yun Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And Gilbert Rosman brought up the possibility of some form of triangulation that the North could engage in, playing China off against America. Is there any possibility in your mind? I mean, obviously the analogy with Nixon's triangulation during the 70s, playing China off against Russia, that's a bit of a stretch. But is there any possibility of that?
I have looked in vain for any evidence-supported precedent by which China was able to coerce North Korea in any meaningful way. For example, get North Korea to back down, not shoot at American planes, blow it up, and kill everyone on board, all 31 servicemen, as North Korea did in 1969. And always in these cases, China, despite expressing some displeasure against North Korea, increased aid to North Korea to placate North Korea. And one might argue that is the adult approach to grit its teeth and appease North Korea, because in the long term, it's in China's interest to keep North Korea around. With respect to Nixon's visit to China, there is a lot of misperception. Many people want to believe in this enduring myth that ping-pong diplomacy paved the way when American table tennis players were dramatically, all of a sudden, invited to come to Beijing in April 1971. And just 3 months later, Henry Kissinger showed up in Beijing. But the two events are not married by cause and effect. In fact, there were some 18 months of secret negotiations between the U.S. and China, principally through their respective embassies in Warsaw, Poland. Why? Because of the common threat of the Soviet Union, because Nixon wanted to create the excitement of winning China back, as he was hopelessly losing Indochina, and because Mao wanted Taiwan's seat in the UN Security Council, and so on. With respect to U.S. and North Korea rapprochement, if there is to be one, there are no such entangling, there is no such convergence of interests. One side wants North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. The other side wants to keep the weapons that the state has assiduously worked to develop. So there is a bit of a problem there in terms of what each side is seeking.
Well, I find it hard to believe that Kim Jong-un will open up his country in terms of the sunshine policy. In spite of the pageantry and the theatrics of the meeting that just took place at Panmunjom on the border, stepping back and forth across and then having that sort of picnic by the picnic tables. And, at the end of the day, what is the likelihood of the North Koreans giving up this massive outsized standing army, firing thousands of these bemedaled generals and removing hundreds of thousands of rockets and artillery tubes targeted at Seoul?
I am shocked to hear you are not moved by the gripping optics of Kim Jong-un smiling for the cameras. Seriously,
well,
one would never entertain for a minute the presumption that it is within the realm of the possible to get any of the eight other nuclear weapon states, the permanent members of the Security Council, and India, Pakistan, and Israel, to give it up through conventional nuclear diplomacy. But when it comes to North Korea, we still want to harbor that illusion, that hope, because North Korea is so backward, has little else, maybe it is possible. I've always posited, precisely for those very same reasons, because North Korea has little else other than military power, it's exceedingly unlikely. One has to return to the basic question of causation. What explains Kim Jong-un's dramatic outreach as of January? Did he wake up one day on New Year's Day and have a moment of epiphany and decided he's going to be a nice guy going forward? Few people would believe that. Then did Mr. Moon, the South Korean president, his patience through Kim Jong-un's year-long bluster. Did that move Kim Jong-un? He was so gratified, he wanted to reciprocate and put on some good behavior? Probably unlikely. Did Trump's verbal threats of fire and fury and total destruction cower Kim Jong-un to change? Highly unlikely in view of the fact that Kim Jong-un, with each of those threats, fired off a missile, conducted a thermonuclear test on September 3rd, fired an ICBM in late November. So the only logical conclusion that I'm able to draw is that this is all premeditated. It's been planned. Why? What is my basis? Because his daddy did virtually the identical things that Kim Jong-un is doing as of 2000. Called for a meeting with the South Korean president, paid his first visit to China a couple of weeks before the meeting in late May, 6 years after coming into power, which is just Kim Jong-un did in late March, 6 years after assuming power. Then called on the U.S., Bill Clinton, to visit Pyongyang, and Clinton, we know, was very keen on it but could not make the trip, and then visited Vladimir Putin in Moscow in August 2001. Next year, received the Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi in Pyongyang. And this is an elaborate process by which the North Korean funny-looking dictator comes to be acknowledged, accepted as a legitimate leader of not such an abnormal country. It's all very elaborate and well thought out.
Well, Trump is already claiming success for the bad haircut summit, which hasn't happened yet. So it's pretty extraordinary what's going on. And you basically have two sort of narcissistic sociopaths sitting down together. And I don't believe Trump will sign anything that makes him look good. And I'm sure the North Korean leader knows that, but that doesn't mean Trump won't get a Nobel Peace Prize and get reelected. So forgive me for being so cynical, Sung Yoon Lee, but what happened between the... Because Trump recently took credit for extraordinary number of things, including the South Korean Winter Olympics. He took credit for that. But I recall that the Vice President Pence made remarks about human rights abuses in North Korea, which offended the North Koreans, and they refused to shake hands, and they sat, as you see from the pictures, behind each one, behind the other, in a kind of frozen attitude. And then shortly thereafter, it suddenly reversed itself, and we know this strange meeting took place at the White House, where the head of South Korea's intelligence service, along with the national security advisor, were in the executive office building, and suddenly they were called over to the White House, and they basically said that they had a good meeting with Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang, and he was open to an American visit. And immediately Trump said, I'm ready for a summit. So, and that shocked everybody. So what do you think happened in that very short time frame, the turnaround from Mike Pence's frozen meeting, non-meeting with the North Korean delegation at the Olympics and this opening?
Hubris and the temptation to carve out some kind of a positive North Korea legacy were given an opportunity by Kim Jong-un's proposition for a date, for a summit meeting. So as you mentioned, Mike Pence, attending the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in early February, brought with him the parents of Otto Warmbier, the college student who was beaten, tortured, and came home in a coma 1.5 years after his detainment and died a few days after coming home. And Mike Pence said that North Korea's outreach to the South is, quote, a charade. It's all a ploy. It's fake. So I am a bit puzzled as to at what point between February 9th, the opening ceremony, and March 8th, when the South Korean envoys, as you mentioned, conveyed to President Trump Kim Jong-un's invitation for a summit. During that brief span of 27 or 8 days, at what point did Kim Jong-un's intentions morph from fake to sincere? This is a very basic question of logic that President Trump needs to ask himself. Previously, American officials, government officials, journalists, academics who have met with Kim the First, Second, and this one too, Mike Pompeo, we know, met with him less than a month ago, have all uniformly come away very impressed at the fact that the North Korean dictator is not only not a raving lunatic, not crazy, but actually quite measured, self-effacing, has a sense of humor, knowledgeable, well-prepared, as Pompeo said of Kim Jong-un. And they come away from these meetings utterly impressed and convinced that they have gained some new deep insight into the nature of the regime, mostly by virtue of their own charisma, magnetic personality, and empathy. Such is the tendency to patronize North Korea. I fear President Trump will sit down with a North Korean tyrant, utterly unprepared, and convinced that he has somehow connected with Kim Jong-un, that he has been able to tame the North Korean leader. That's a trap.
Well, on the other hand, the Korean War could end, and the success at the summit, whether it's a real success or not, the cosmetics may be sufficient. To get Trump the Nobel Peace Prize and re-elected. So one can't underestimate the possibility of that happening. But you've made the case that that the North Koreans have just about reneged on every deal that they've made. But it's also true on the other side that the U.S. hasn't been the most reliable partner. I mean, under Clinton, they agreed to get rid of their heavy water reactor that was creating, making plutonium and replace it with a light water reactor along with fuel oil. And the Republicans under Newt Gingrich scuttled that deal. So are the North Koreans, do they have a case of that the U.S. may not be the most reliable person to negotiate with?
Well, North Koreans would be crazy if they were to place full faith, full trust in what Americans say, and vice versa, of course. However, during those years, from 1995 to 2008, so for much of the Clinton-George W. Bush continuum, the U.S. gave North Korea more than $1.3 billion in aid, all for North Korea's lies, repeated lies of denuclearization. So that's about $100 million a year flowing into North Korea's coffers, which is a pretty good deal from the regime's point of view. That's what North Korea seeks. Moreover, North Korea wants to get Trump to concede, give other concessions like stop enforcing sanctions, which is crimping his style. And in the meantime, buy time and money, I guess, with which to perfect his own nuclear posture review. So all these gestures, verbal palliative that is amenable to denuclearization talks, and his willingness to shut down the main nuclear site in the northeastern corner of his nation, these are great, but they're, they make for good theatrics. But when you've seen Rambo 1, 2, and 3 repeatedly, by the time Rambo 4 comes around, you have a pretty good idea how things will turn out.
But Trump is laying the groundwork. I mean, he blames everything on his predecessor, particularly Barack Obama, but he's blaming the North Korean-South Korean Cold War since 1953 on his predecessors. I guess that includes Clinton and George W. Bush, and is basically saying, I'm going to fix a problem that my predecessors have failed. So he's already staking out a pretty high bar there, don't you think?
Trump's predecessors do deserve blame for their failure to denuclearize North Korea. But of course, this is a very difficult calling. We're not talking about shrimp quota trade negotiations, no offense. But I mean, nuclear diplomacy, short of waging war, is international politics played at the highest level. At the same time, none of his predecessors walked right into this kind of elaborate trap set by the North Korean leader and legitimated the North Korean leader by holding a summit meeting with him. A summit meeting very much unlike a blind date or a family reunion, inherent deficiencies in both notwithstanding, but a summit meeting is the culmination really the culmination of months, if not years, of tough negotiations. You have to reach an agreement on the key issues at hand, even between allies. The summit meeting should come at the end of that lengthy, protracted, difficult process, not at the start, and then start negotiating. So Trump is really walking right into this trap, which may be quite damaging to U.S. interests, more so than not negotiating at all.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, does that make the South Koreans the adults in the room? I mean, obviously you have this situation we've got in the North. You've basically got the tyranny of the weak, who are able to leverage these nuclear weapons. Maybe they've got a dozen or so. We don't know whether they could actually couple them with these long-range missiles, but at this point, the U.S. intelligence services have accepted the possibility that the North Koreans could target at least a dozen major American cities, and that is completely unacceptable. So they've got our attention, shall we say. But on the other side, you've got a lot of idealism, a lot of, the optics coming out of South Korea of these people in the street watching these giant jumbo screens is a very emotional moment for the South Koreans. So I guess my question would be, is North, the tyranny of the weak in the North, going to con the idealism of the South?
South Koreans are more than eager to be duped because it's quite uplifting whenever there is inter-Korean contact, especially at the highest level. And admittedly, South Korea has far more to lose in escalating tension with North Korea than the other side. So there's just simply no stomach on the part of the government or the public, more importantly, to escalate tit for tat, and the preferred option, the default position, is always to de-escalate and placate and give more money to North Korea. At the same time, I would say South Korea is more playing a supporting role to North Korea's post-provocation peace ploy phase, and deserves some blame for that. President Moon, in my humble opinion, went way overboard in hosting Kim Jong-un and his royal family, did not bring up any substantive issues like human rights or process by which North Korea would denuclearize North Korea instead of the Korean Peninsula, as it's always said. And the two men joining hands, walking hand in hand, side by side, to and fro across the militarized border, affectionately. I mean, that makes for great optics, but it's eerily reminiscent of the final scene, the final lines of Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, when one of the twin clowns, upon finding his long-lost brother, says, "We came into the world like brother and brother, and now let's go hand in hand, not one before another." The two men are not brothers. They are not friends. They are adversaries. North Korea is engaged in a long-term systemic contest for survival against the more attractive, legitimate Korean state. I think the South Korean government needs to be aware of that.
Well, Sung-Yoon Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.